No human culture, society, has ever discovered a foolproof way to handle, to control, to redirect the more violent impulses and actions of mankind. It would seem that our propensity to be violent frustrates even God. At least that's the burden of the biblical legend. The world was then much as it now is. Vatimaleha aretz chamas. The earth was covered with violence. And God was so frustrated by the unwillingness of his creatures to act with decency, sensitivity, love, understanding each to the other, to be civilized, that he was moved to act in the most ungodlike way, much as human beings do. He was moved to blot out the human race. Kates kol basar balafanai ki malah haaretz chamas. I've determined upon an end to humankind because they have filled this earth of mine with violence. And so there came the flood, and mankind was wiped out except for Noah and his progeny. And even as God allowed the flood to rage, he recognized the irrationality of his anger. He had saved the good man, Noah. But Noah was, after all, a human being, and so was his wife, and so would be his children. And some would show some character, and others would be without character, and some would have the will to discipline their more violent impulses, and some would not. And the whole tragedy of which is human history would begin to unfold again. And so God swears a great oath. Lo akalel od et ha'adama v'avur ha'adam. I will not again curse the earth because of man. Ki ra lev adam min urav. Because the devisings of man's heart are devious, pernicious from birth. And as symbol of this decision, God places the rainbow in the sky and promises seed time and harvest, day and night, heat and cold, summer and winter shall not cease. Life will go on, and man will have to make the best of it that he can. Now, our propensity to be men of cruelty and to be rather vicious in some of our activity frustrates even God, and we cannot expect to find pat, neat, quick solutions to the problems of violence. And yet there are abroad among us those who offer us precisely such neat, quick, pat solutions as if they were God. No one likes to see all the locks that appear on the door of a modern apartment or a modern home. No one likes to have to call up an agency to put expensive electronic equipment, sensor equipment in one's home, and other to protect one's family and one's belongings. No one likes to think of his neighbors carrying mace about in their car or a gun on their persons. And so we're moved, being impatient creatures, to turn to quick solutions. And some say, there's an easy way to deal with violence, suppress it. What we need to have is more police, and better trained police, and police with more modern equipment. What we need is to have quicker arraignment and quicker trials and harsher sentences and stricter jails and less parole. If we suppress violence, violence will disappear. And there are others who say, that's not the way. There's another way, equally guaranteed. Violence is bred in poverty and in misery and in want. Eradicate the the poverty in our society. Give everyone enough to eat, equal opportunity. Destroy the prejudice that roils in human society. Eliminate urban blight. You'll destroy the sources of violence, that which causes violence in man. You will come to a society which is non-violent. Now, unfortunately, evidence belies both of these simplicities. The rise in violence in modern times has been pronounced in a repressive society such as Russia's, quite as much as in a libertarian society such as these United States. We visited several years ago the city of Madras. It's a city in India the size and population of Cleveland. But the poverty and the misery of life in Madras beggars anything that we've ever known in our city. Yet that year, Madras had a single murder during the entire 12 months. And our city had a murder every single day. I'm afraid that the one thing we can say with certainty about violence is that it will be our partner throughout our lives. That it will be part of the environment in which we must live. And that one of the requirements of wisdom is to learn to accept a certain degree of violence, to accommodate to it, and to live openly and as freely and as largely as we can despite it. I confess that I am not much impressed by those deliberate saints among us who have determined to live in this world as if it were in fact the world of their dreams, as if the Messianic age were already here. They feel shielded by their own innocence. And so they walk deliberately and carelessly on the wild side. And they go about continuing to hitchhike on the streets without thought to the human pathology which may be behind the wheel of a car which stops to pick them up until they become another statistic, the rising numbers of those who are assaulted or raped or worse. Now, obviously, it is folly to do what some are doing in our community and elsewhere, to lock themselves in from life, to become so afraid, so fearful of the headlines, what the headlines tell them the world out there is like, that they can move only from one locked cubicle, their home, to another locked cubicle, their car, to another locked cubicle, the home of some relative or friend, that otherwise the city is no man's land to them. They deny to themselves all of the art, all of the literature, all of the companionship, all of the opportunity which a great city like ours affords. But it's equally folly, it seems to me, to live without some modicum of prudence, without care for one's person, without a recognition that this is a violent world and that at certain places and certain times it is simply unwise to be there unaccompanied, alone. Again, I would give you a biblical image. I remind you of the biblical image of the Messianic age, so precious to us. It's our hope. A time when every man shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree in his home, and none shall make him afraid. Now we have come so far, so fast in the last century or so. We have lengthened the lifespan. We have given man a new sense of his health. We have destroyed the burden of back-breaking labor. We have surrounded our lives with the kinds of wealth and luxury and support that the Caesars of old did not enjoy. We have come so far so fast that most of us find it difficult to admit that some of these problems cannot be met and cannot be faced, that in fact we can't have the Messianic age in 1974, or at least by the year 2000, in our own lifetime, or at least in the lifetime of our children. But look at the Bible, a wise book, good book to look at carefully. The Bible doesn't say that the Messianic age will come next year or 25 years from now. The Bible says there will be a messianic age, b'acharit hayamim, at the end of times, not in time. And it does not promise the messianic age for such as us, creatures of a competitive world, creatures who have been informed and imprinted by an environment which is suffused with violence. The messianic age will come when God will have created a new form of human life, a new breed, lev chadash, ruach chadasha, a new spirit, a new heart. Then and only then will lion lie down with the lamb, will men beat their swords into plowshares, will a little child lead them successfully. The messianic dream is the dream that moves us on to do what must be done, to make the sacrifices which must be made. But it's not here. Our world is as the world of Noah's age, a world filled with violence. And it's to that world which we must adjust. And it's to the limitation of that world's violence that we must, you know, commit ourselves. Violence. The very word cries out to be defeated. Of what is violence made? One of the problems that we face is that compared to our science, compared to our technology, our knowledge of ourselves, of man, is primitive, rudimentary at most. After all, it's only a generation and a half since Dr. Freud. We haven't even begun to agree in a basic, gross definition of what mankind is, what man is like. We can't even begin to describe the problem with which violence faces us. One school of social scientists tells us that violence, the fighting instinct, the instinct to flail out, to take advantage, to impose, to lean on another, is imprinted on the human spirit. It's part of the inherited animal mechanisms of the body. It's a natural thing. That the most we can hope for is to redirect the violence of the human spirit into actions which are not destructive of another human being, into sport, into competition, business, culture, and the like. There are others who tell us that violence is part of the defense mechanism of the human body. There are danger signals that are inside the neurological system of man. And when danger is before us, these systems come into play. We become more tense, more alert. We make instinctive decisions whether to flee, whether to fight, whether to react, how to react. And those who argue in this way, who see aggression, the fighting instinct, violence as a response to danger, give us the hope that if we remove the danger, we remove the need to respond violently, create a calm, a generous, a secure environment, and you, by definition, calm man down. Some years ago, Dr. Konrad Lorenz popularized the first approach to the problem of human violence in this little book, which he called On Aggression. A naturalist by trade, Dr. Lorenz saw that the force of violence in the animal world, its usefulness to the animal world, in terms of protecting territory, protecting food supply, allowing the natural, stronger leaders of the pack to rise to the forefront. He spoke of it as a survival mechanism which has been developed by the pressures of survival, one which remains imprinted on the human soul. Dr. Lorenz, and to those who argue as he does, one cannot expect to control violence. Violence is essentially an instinctive and irrational response of man. All we can hope to do is to create ways in which we can sublimate the competitive, the more violent instincts of our soul into work, into constructive forms of competition. On the other hand, men such as Dr. Theodore Lids, who is the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Yale's Medical School, argue that all we need to do to control violence, really, is to create a world to which we need not respond with violence. Remove the enemies of mankind from the world, and in a sense you will remove the need to be violent. And as proof of his position, Dr. Lidge offers the example of the Fiji Island natives. He lived for some period of time among them, he says, and during that period he went back into their history and he discovered that 100 years ago or more, they were known by all who came and traded among them as treacherous, violent people, bloodthirsty. They were cannibals. Each island was in constant war with all other islands, in which there was a different clan, a different house. And they were known as the most irresponsible, irascible, and difficult of all human beings. And today, he says, they're warm-hearted and generous and calm. Cannibalism is forgotten. There's no bloodlust or blood feuds anymore among them. They live cooperatively. They are generous of heart and generous of spirit. What has happened? What happened, according to Dr. Lidge, is that the British came and imposed their rule upon the Fiji Islanders, and they did not allow the blood feuds to continue. And the blood feuds, by definition, had to be ceased. They could live together now as one people. And the British brought with them modern medicine. And no longer do these islanders have to fear the pestilence that comes secretly at night, the devils and the spirits of the shades of the night. Their lives were no longer threatened by the irrational, that to which they could not respond. They began to quiet down and to enjoy the abundance of the natural paradise in which they found themselves. Having removed the ancient causes of tension, the enemy without, the fears without, according to Dr. Lidge, we create a culture which is passive and calm, which has no need to be violent within itself. Now, there's much that's encouraging in an approach such as that of Dr. Lidge. It's the approach we'd like to take to the problem of violence. It suggests to us that the answer to violence is a kind of social reform and social reconstruction that we want to do anyway. To eliminate poverty, to create adequate systems of education, to bring decent housing to all, equal opportunity, to remove the barriers of hate, of race, and the like, all that we call social reconstruction. If we do these things, then we are deliberately not only solving some social ills, but we are attacking the problem of violence. And Dr. Lidge's analysis has one other benefit, in that it allows us to see violence in its fullness. We tend to think of violence only as the act of the criminal against the householder, only of the act of those outside the law against the respectable within the law. There is a hidden violence, a silent violence, implicit in every society. It's the violence of the privileged against the underprivileged. It's the violence of those who have against those who have not. It's the violence of the powerful against those who are powerless. All that keeps a class, a group, a race suppressed. Violence can be social. Violence can be a matter of status. Violence can be the closed door to economic opportunity. Violence exists in many ways in a society. And Dr. Lidge's analysis helps us to see those elements of violence within the so-called genteel parts of society, which most of us, because we are of the more fortunate, tend to overlook. Obviously, social reconstruction needs to be undertaken. But I wonder if we can make the claim that there is a direct relationship between solving the social problems of our society and removing the sources, the causes, the existence of violence within our society. I'm troubled by the fact that during the last 25 years, the rates of crimes against persons, of violent activity in our society, has risen precisely among that class of people who are the freest, who have the most opportunity, and who are most able to enjoy the abundance that this nation has to offer, our own juveniles, our own adolescents. One cannot prove from history, from the evidence of our day, that once you create a good, open, and clean society, by definition, you remove violence. I give you another biblical legend. Our Bible is instructive again and again on this point. It's the story of Cain and Abel. Adam and Eve have been driven from paradise. The world is a green and fertile world which God has placed for their descendants. All they must do is work at it. There's enough for everyone. There's only two clans in this world, the clan of Cain and the clan of Abel. And Abel is the shepherd and Cain is the farmer, and they don't compete for territory. There's enough for both of them. One year at the end of the harvest time, each determines to offer a sacrifice to God. And for reasons that are not clear, God accepts the sacrifice of Abel and he rejects the sacrifice of Cain. And Cain commits in jealousy and anger the first murder. The first murder had nothing to do with economics. It had nothing to do with deprivation. It had nothing to do with being a social outcast. It had to do with jealousy, with a deep green, with a green monster within each of us, with the irrational needs that we all have to be equal or better, to be more, to be accepted rather than to be rejected. And these elements, these irrational elements which contribute to violence, are not removed when we remove the social ills of our society. Let me give you a little bit of interesting background from our own Jewish history. As you know, during the long European experience, crimes against persons, violent activity was very rare in the ghetto, in the shtetl, in our communities. In the decade before the First World War, when sociological investigation was undertaken for the first time, a number of European Jewish sociologists and penologists were intrigued in this fact. Why was it that Jews were involved in crimes of violence against persons, Jew or non-Jew, to a much less degree than their neighbors? They were the persecuted, they were the oppressed, they were the outcast. The violence should be in their soul, but it was not. And they went first to get some gross statistics. The statistics were revealing. In Tsarist Russia, where the repression was the sternest and the strictest, Jews were involved in acts of violence against others only to 25% of the ratio of such activity by non-Jews, by the persecutors. And when one moved over to the West, to Poland, where life was suppressed, but there was some freedom, there was a degree of ambiguity in the early 1900s in the Jewish situation, the percentage went up to 55%. Instead of the ratio being 1 in 4, it was now essentially 1 in 2. We were approaching the average, the norm of human society. And when one moved further west to Berlin, where there was essentially economic freedom, though there was a good bit of social repression, the Jewish ratio was now 70% of the non-Jewish ratio. And in the freest city of them all, with the least amount of suppression, in Amsterdam, the ratio went up to 75%. Somehow there was a ratio, an unexpected ratio, between a rise in crimes of violence and the degree of freedom and opportunity which that particular group, our group in the society, enjoyed. And one could, I suspect, draw the same figures if one looked at, say, the black or the Puerto Rican or the Indian population statistics in these United States. Now let me take this European Jewish community to the Holy Land. Here, where they are no longer outcasts, even socially, what do we find? We find that to Palestine, the pre-independence country, the Jews brought a pattern of life which retained the statistics of the ghetto. There was very little crime against persons, crimes of violence, in pre-1948 Israel. With independence, with freedom, the statistics begin to rise. And they've risen steadily every single year of Israel's independence. Until today, they approximate the rate of crimes against person in all of the other free industrial states of the modern world. The French sociologist Emile Durkheim once observed that crime against persons, crimes of violence, may be a normal function of human society. And one of the Zionist purposes, you know, in creating the State of Israel was to allow Jewish society to be normalized. They didn't think of crime as a normal human behavior, but apparently it is. And the proof of our normality can be found in these crime statistics if we're looking for it. I'm fascinated by these figures because they suggest that far from solving the problems of violence, the movement from being persecuted toward being free, from deprivation to opportunity, may in fact increase the tendency to violence within a given social order. That as a matter of fact, the rise in violence in the 1950s and 60s in the West may directly be linked to the growing economic and social opportunity which is enjoyed in the cities of the West. Now let me put these statistics against another grid. Violence rises as the Jewish communities move from East to West, from suppression to emancipation, because emancipation came historically in an uneven way at different times to the Jewish communities of Europe. One can look at these statistics in another way. In Russia, because of persecution, in 1900, 1910, the Jewish community was still solid, compact, cohesive. It still was based on a kind, on the old world medieval self-governing process. It was an extension of one's family. There was a tight-knit web of practice, of relationships, of ties, which had not yet been shattered or broken in any way. The further west one comes, the more the individual moves out of the all-embracing community, the more he is on his own, the more he must face the buffets and the bruisings of life without the support of family, of an extended community, without the support of rituals and self-help and mutual help organizations which sustain him, the more times he finds himself, you know, in a corner, his fists up, having to defend himself against the malignity and the dangers and the frustrations of a very difficult world. It's very hard and very dangerous to have to face life alone. And one can, I think, show historically that when persecution forced a community to turn in on itself, to be loving and caring and supportive and sustaining, not only within the narrow confines of husband, wife, parent, child, but in all the extended confines of the group, then whatever, however difficult life may be, it was difficult for everyone, however dangerous life may be, there was someone who would succor, someone who would nurse, someone who would encourage. You could turn to someone for help. You weren't alone, cornered, boxed in. If this, in fact, be the case, it would suggest, I submit, that the direction which Western society is moving, in which Western society is moving, is precisely the direction which is guaranteed to increase again and again the level of violence in the environment in which we find ourselves. Because what's the drive of Western life? For radical freedom. To do one's own thing, to be on one's own, to get away from the mesh of family, the mesh of one's congregation, the mesh of one's neighborhood, the mesh of one's environment, to be out and walking one's own way in the world, whatever happens. Now, if the world were the womb, a warm, comforting, loving place, to walk one's own way would be unmitigated joy. But the world's a bruising place. It's a place full of human pathology. It's a place which is competitive and often careless of human values, not to speak of human life. And when one walks alone, away, and suddenly there's illness, Suddenly there's an accident. Suddenly we're bruised. Suddenly we're frustrated. Suddenly a door is slammed in our face. Then all the defenses of the body become tense and tight. And if we're not very disciplined, we become, you know, instinctively we begin to flail out and to strike back. Perhaps some of the drive among those who have walked away from family, from the ties of the past, and have tried to create, you know, these urban communes, these farming communes, these new communities, has been precisely the attempt to find support, the ties which will allow them to accept the cruelties of life without breaking or needing to become angry and violent in response. But the trouble with so many of these communes is that they lack an economic base, they lack historic continuity, they lack the rituals that encourage and sustain. So many of them are simply chronologically of one age, and as people's interests move on, the commune begins to break up. They're very temporary, but they suggest, in the kind of groping that has gone into their creation, they suggest, I submit, a basic need in our Western way of life. And that's a need not only to reform the society, but that's a need to find in our society new groups, or I would suggest old historic groups, such as a congregation, in which we can feel a part, necessary, needed, which will encourage, which will support, and provide friendship, a listening ear, encouragement financially, morally, spiritually, when we need it. All those strengths without which it's so easy to break, given the tensions, given the stress, given the violence of modern life. Hillel said it centuries and centuries ago. Al tifrosh min hatzibur. Separate not yourself from the community. Because the man who, or woman, who walks alone, unaided, unsupported, will again and again in life find the need for support and aid and love, and find it difficult to find, unless in a sense the society has created the groups where they can be rooted and encouraged. I don't know, as I suggest to you, the solution to the problems of violence. But I would suggest to you that suppression is not the way. I would suggest to you that social reform is the way to reform the society, but will not in and of itself solve the problem of violence. And I would suggest to you that if we are truly concerned with the rising tide of violence within our society, all of us had better rethink a value we have made supreme, which in fact ought not to be supreme. That value we call freedom, that value which we call our ability to go our own way, uninvolved with those among whom we happen to find ourselves. Man is by nature a social being. Man requires the support of other human beings in order to survive. Stripped of that support, as modern urban society has stripped him, man is all too often a cornered beast. And the beast that is cornered is a dangerous being indeed. Amen.